Okay, Ms. Rivoli, first question. Why did you write this book, and why a t-shirt?
Why a t-shirt, and why did I write the book? Oh, well, to start with the first question, why did I write the book? I have taught for many years in the university the subjects international economics, international business, international trade, and for many students and also for many people in the general population, these subjects are very dry and very boring and very intimidating sometimes because we tend to take a lot of the personality out of these topics when we teach about them. And so, but to my view, the topics were very interesting. You know, they had a lot of human drama, a lot of human emotion, and it seems like sometimes as professors we take all this out, you know. And I thought, you know, these stories about trade and globalization, they really have all of the elements of the best novels, really, you know. There are interesting characters, there's a lot of tension, there are a lot of moral dilemmas. And so I wanted to write something that really reflected the drama that really is a part of trade and globalization, instead of the typical things that we write in universities where we, it seems to me, it takes the drama out. So I thought that I could write something that was engaging to people on this topic. I also wrote the book because so much of what I have seen starts with a very strong point of view. You know, books that are in favor of globalization, books that are opposed to globalization. And I thought the world doesn't need another book like that. So instead, can I tell a story, really, about globalization without really having a point of view being, you know, the point of the whole thing. So I didn't want to write a book that was telling people what to think. I wanted to write a book that instead was a story that people would like to read. And then as far as the t-shirt part, you know, in the U.S. and also in Europe, especially in the past 10 years, the apparel industry has been kind of at the center of globalization debates because people are very worried about, we know we call it sweatshops in the U.S., very poor labor conditions under which our apparel is made, especially in Asia. And in the U.S., there were a lot of, and also in Europe, a lot of protests against sweatshops and the conditions under which apparel was made. And so apparel is kind of symbolic, you know, for many people about what is wrong with globalization. And so I wanted to write about the t-shirt for that reason, and also because it's something that everybody understands. You know, everybody has a t-shirt in their drawer, you know, instead of writing about, you know, semiconductors or something like that. It's the t-shirt everybody can relate to. So I think if you take an everyday object and you put it in this, you know, very complicated story, people will engage with it better, you know, if they know, you know, it's on their back or it's in their drawer, everybody can relate. So that's why.
By the way, my wife, who is reading the book, enjoyed very much the way in which you intertwine the narrative of the single stories, the people you meet, and the broad picture, the ideas and the statistical data.
Right. You know, it was something that was my goal, was to intertwine them, because a lot of times in the popular press you see only the stories of the people, and then in the academic literature you see only the statistics and the theory and the data. But I thought, you know, it would be better if we could bring them together. So I'm glad.
Thank you.
I'm glad she. You must tell her. Thank you. I'm glad she liked it.
My second question: in your journey,
yes.
you challenged many ideas, both of those in favor of free trade and of no global protesters.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is your view of globalization?
I think that you can't be opposed to globalization, because that's like, you know, being opposed to the sun coming up. You know, it's something that is happening, whether we like it or not. But I think what we can do is we have to have the systems in place to write the rules about how globalization proceeds. You know, it's like anything in an economy, you know, there are no successful economies that just let the market run wild. You know, in any successful economy in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, you know, these economic systems are embedded in cultures, in laws, in institutions. And so I think we have to have the best possible laws and institutions in place so that globalization proceeds in a way that's consistent, you know, with our values and our goals. And so, for example, that's why I think it's very important that you have in place things like labor protection laws, you know, so that people are not exploited, or at least not exploited as much. I think it's very important that you have NGOs that are monitoring factories, for example. So I think globalization is with us whether we like it or not, but it's the responsibility, particularly of the richer countries, to put in place the systems and the laws and the rules to govern the process so that it's not something that is so threatening to people.
You are an economist.
By training, yeah.
By training, yes. But markets play a rather minor role in the story of your dessert.
It was not my plan. My plan was really to write a book about the markets and the business associated with the life of this t-shirt. Because that is my background, as you say. But once I started my research, you know, what I learned is that if I really was going to tell the story of the t-shirt in an accurate way, it was so much a story about politics. And so what I learned in uncovering my research is that to understand this t-shirt's life, you know, the t-shirt was made from Texas cotton because of politics. You know, the t-shirt, the trade policy that governs apparel trade is all political, you know. And so rather than talking about things like comparative advantage and market-driven trade flows, I realized that at least for this product, not for all products, but at least for this product, its life story could only be explained with reference to the politics, not so much the markets. And so it wasn't my intention, you know, but it's something that I learned, and I hope the reader learns, you know, when they read the book, that, you know, so much of what we talk about, and we think we're talking about markets and economics, we're really talking about politics.
You say that the best hope for poor countries lies in sort of cooperation between globalization and the forces
against
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you explain this apparent paradox?
Yeah, of course. You know, we tend to look at the corporate and the economic interests as being opposed to the anti-globalization interests. We tend to view these two as sort of enemies, you know, pro-globalization, anti-globalization. And I think they view themselves often as enemies. But if you step back and take an objective view, what you realize is that in the process of fighting against one another, these two sides really create progress. Okay? If you didn't have the corporations with investing the capital, then you would have such limits, you know, on economic growth. But if you didn't have the activists checking the corporate behavior, putting pressure where the pressure is needed, shining the lights, you know, to expose abuses, you know, then you would have a whole different kind of business environment. And most of the companies now who are engaged in the apparel business, they will say, we think that the protests, the anti-sweatshop protests, the anti-globalization protests that happened 5 to 10 years ago were very good for us. You know, looking back, it was a fight, but now we think it's very good. We have much better systems in place to oversee kind of the integrity, the quality of the supply chain. So I think the two sides, they need each other, you know. The companies, they need the watchdogs. And, of course, the watchdogs, they need something to watch, you know.
The activists are playing in some way the role which Adam Smith attributed to moral rules of conduct.
Exactly. You know, I think that all markets, they need a moral voice. They need, you know, as human beings, you know, we think in moral terms. And so they are a very important part of this. And they always have been, you know, going back to the Industrial Revolution in Britain, you had people with moral points of view, you know, who opposed child labor, for example. And without such people, you know, it's difficult to imagine what the world would be like. So I think very much the two sides, they need each other.
What about the rich countries? Many people in rich countries feel threatened by globalization as well, which is the best hope for them, in your view?
You know, I think people in rich countries, they're very, there's a lot of diversity. In the United States, there's been some research done on the textile industry, you know, which, like in Europe, it's in trouble because of competition from Asia. And the research shows that, roughly speaking, when a textile factory closes in the South, in the America, 1 year later, about a third of the people who were fired, who lost their job, will be better off. You know, they will say to you, and I've talked to them, you know, this was a good thing to happen because now I've gone on to do this or this or this. About a third of the people a year later will say that they feel like they're in the same position as they were before. But about a third will say, no, my life is much worse. And so there is a lot of variation in opinion. And for the people who are worse off, this is where I would come back to my initial point. You know, we need things in place in our country to protect them, to develop their skills so that they can make a change. We need things in place so that they can further their education. And I think the more adaptable the workers are, the less threatened they will feel, you know. And so this is key. In the United States, we have many people who, you know, they assumed that they would always be able to have the job in the textile mill. And so they didn't finish high school, you know, or they didn't learn to operate the computer, or, you know, they didn't develop their skills in such a way that would allow them to make a move from one thing to another. And so this is, I think, the role of the government, of society, to make sure people have the opportunity to develop themselves in a way that makes them flexible. This is very important. And if they feel flexible, then they won't feel so threatened, you know.
As far as you know the Italian reality, how do you see the perspective of Italy in the game of globalization?
Well, you know, Italy was among the first globalizing countries, you know. You invented international banking here in Italy, you know, and you've been a leader in many international industries. But I think in Italy and in Europe as well, I think you have the same tensions as we do in the United States. You know, there are certain sectors that historically Italy has been a leader in. If you look at textiles, apparel, shoes, that it's so difficult to maintain your competitive position given that your wages are probably about 20, 30 times as high as they are in China. So I think this is the same challenge that we have in the United States. You know, how to maintain some presence in these industries. And of course, I think Italy has been fairly successful. I mean, nobody argues against the quality of life in Italy. You know, you have a very... I said to my daughter, you know, we were talking about this, how much this life is very good here, you know.
Everybody coming from abroad.
Well, even for Americans, it looks to us like life is very good here. So I think, you know, I can understand why people here would feel very uneasy or threatened about trying to protect that. Because, you know, it's the uncertainty, you know, in Europe, not just in Italy, but also especially in Germany and France, the uncertainty about, you know, whether this good life can be maintained in the face of the international competition is a big question, big question. In the U.S., we don't have the good life so much, so it's a little different, you know. It's interesting, you know, that in Europe, people take the vacation, you know, like for the summer, you know. In the U.S., we take it for, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks. I can understand why in Europe you want to try to protect these things. I would also, you know, if I were in this position.
Only the future will tell.
That's right, that's right.
A final question by my wife.
Your wife, okay, very good. And her name is?
Anna.
Anna.
Who is the reader you had in mind when writing the book?
That's a good question. I know that when I was thinking about the book, people who were giving me advice, they said, you know, you need to have what they call a target market, you know, who you are writing for. And I have to say I didn't have a specific target market in mind. I wanted to write for people who were curious about trade and globalization, but not a particular group, you know, not business people or students or academics. You know, I wanted the book to have something for everybody who was curious about globalization. And one of the most rewarding things for me, and I think, you know, I can't thank people like your wife, Anna, is people who thought they had no interest in these topics. You know, they thought that they really didn't want to read about international trade or globalization. A lot of times they said to me, you know, I would never read a book about economics, but I read your book and, you know, I liked your book. So for, to me, I'm very glad to have, you know, reached those people. And especially, you know, a lot of people, they already know what they think. You know, and it's a story like this, maybe it's not going to change anybody's mind if they already have an opinion. But for people like your wife who, you know, are maybe intrigued or curious, hadn't really thought too much about it, the fact that the book has reached such people is a great reward for me. So you can, again, you can thank Anna for me.
Very often when a book is not for somebody in particular,
nobody
reads it. I think this time it is really for almost everybody curious about this subject.
You know, it's not everybody will take the same thing from the book. You know, I think for academics they pick up some different things. You know, there are some you know, references to the academic literature and so forth that other people maybe they just kind of skip over. So I think people read it in different ways, you know. A lot of people, they like the story, you know, they like to read about the people involved, you know. Other people, they like some of the history. So, you know, I think the book also is done well also among academics. You know, and I'm happy about that too, because, you know, in universities we tend to be a little bit snobby, you know.
Academics don't like storytelling.
Exactly. And so a lot of times, you know, people could say, well, that's just a story, it's not serious. But I really haven't had that reaction at least, you know, not to my face. And people, people, I think, in academics, I think they appreciate, you know, kind of trying to do things a little bit in a new way every once in a while. Especially in the field of economics, we tend to be very rigid, you know, always do everything the same way. So I think even in that field, people appreciate a different kind of approach. So
we wish all the best for this book.
Well, thank you so much for everything you've done for the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.